Good morning, Southside family. Please turn to 1 Timothy chapter 3. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 to 7 is where we'll be today. Title of the sermon is The Anatomy of Godly Leadership. We'll have a two-part series on leadership, one on the overseer, otherwise known as bishops, pastors. Thankful to Cliff to raising the same terminology in Acts 20. Where Paul calls the elders of Ephesus, and then in the same context refers to them as overseers and tells them to shepherd the church of God, highlighting the different connotations of elders. We have a couple of people visiting with us today. We have Carrie Ann and her daughter Grace. Grace is going to be attending. Grace, if you guys would just yeah, she's waving there, and her mother is next to her. They're from Missouri. Grace is going to be attending school at UWM. She's going to start in the fall in library science, and she's looking for a church home. We're hoping that it will be this church home, but we're going to help her find the best church home. Grace, we want you to know that we will support you in your endeavors should you decide to go here or elsewhere. We want to be a resource for you, and we hope that God will guide you to find a good church home that will support you in your studies. Any other visitors today? All right, well, you two are very, very special. Welcome. Welcome this morning. 1 Timothy chapter 3. Someone wanted to be a doctor. That would be a pretty high calling for him or for her. With that high calling comes high qualifications. Not just anyone can be a doctor. It's not enough to just say, I want to be a doctor. That's necessary. Because if you didn't want to be a doctor, then you shouldn't go through with it. But just because you have the desire doesn't mean that you should go through with it. Because it is a high calling. I swear to fulfill, to the best of my ability and judgment, this covenant. I will respect the hard-won scientific gains of those physicians in whose steps I walk, and gladly share such knowledge as is mine with those who are to follow. I will apply for the benefit of the sick all measures which are required, avoiding those twin traps of overtreatment and therapeutic nihilism. I will remember that there is an art to medicine as well as science, and that warmth, sympathy, and understanding may outweigh the surgeon's knife or the chemist's drug. I will not be ashamed to say I know not, nor will I fail to call in my colleagues when the skills of another are needed for a patient's recovery. I will respect the privacy of my patients, for their problems are not disclosed to me that the world may know. Most especially must I tread with care in matters of life and death. If it is given me to save a life, all thanks. But it may also be within my power to take a life. This awesome responsibility must be faced with great humbleness and awareness of my own frailty. Above all, I must not play God. I will remember that I do not treat a fever chart, a cancerous growth, but a sick human being, whose illness may affect the person's family and economic stability. My responsibility includes these related problems. If I am to care adequately for the sick, I will prevent disease whenever I can, for prevention is preferable to cure. I will remember that I remain a member of society with special obligations to all my fellow human beings, those sound of mind and body as well as the infirm. If I do not violate this oath, may I enjoy life and art, respected while I live and remembered with affection thereafter. May I always act so as to preserve the finest traditions of my calling, and may I long experience the joy of healing those who seek my help. Now, what did I just read? The Hippocratic Oath, the modern version of it, which was written in 1964, stemming from the original that goes back to the 5th century BC, attributed to the physician Hippocrates. As you can see, being a doctor has a high calling, and there are high qualifications that must be met to be a doctor. there are some pros and cons that must be considered in addition to the weightiness of the oath that I just read. Here's some pros that I've taken from an article that was written in 2021 about why one should or should not be a doctor. The pros and cons that should be considered for those who have aspirations for the medical field. Here are the pros that were listed. Money, 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 money. Money. That's not in the hymn book. In fact, it's something that elders are exhorted to avoid. They should not be consumed with a love of money. Not that they shouldn't have it, a love of it. $313 average salary for a physician, according to this article. It's perhaps a big pro. Another pro is that you have job security. With the proliferation of artificial intelligence that is pushing out jobs, people are always going to need people to treat the sick. Physicians won't be going anywhere. Technology is advancing, but we still will need physicians. And then another pro is the fact that you are saving and you are impacting lives. I'm sure many of you have experienced perhaps life-saving treatment or something that has altered something in a loved one. That's meaningful, very impacting, and that's got to be enriching to know that you have a task, a job that impacts lives in that way. Now, here's some cons. Grace is starting school. We know that some doctors have a lot of school. And when I say a lot, I mean a lot. A lot, a lot, a lot. Some doctors have to go to school for about 15 years, depending upon their specialty, before they can start practicing. Then there's the debt that comes along with your education. You're prepared to be able to fork over in loan payments about $50,000 a year on average, it seems. Then you do the math. 15 years of schooling times $50,000. And then I think something that we know full well with the pandemic, you can see on the news frequently, is that nurses, doctors, people treating people are burned out. Physical, mental, emotional burnout, carrying the weight and the burden of your patients and wanting them to get better and sometimes not being able to make that happen. Those are some of the pros and cons. And so with the high calling of one that desires to be a doctor, there comes high qualifications that must be met. And we would say, if you want to be a doctor, you need to consider all these pros and all these cons. Can you do the schooling? Do you want to pay back the loans? Do you want to experience the physical and emotional burnout sometimes that comes with treating patients, along with the good sides? In a similar way, leading a church is a high calling. 1 Timothy 3:1 says, if anyone has aspirations to the office of a bishop or overseer, that person desires a noble task. Therefore, an overseer must be above reproach. We can go to the slide here. I'm going to try to advance it some. There we go. Two very, very handsome men. If I do say so myself. Right, Gene? Right, Peggy? Grace, just to introduce you to our elders, one of them is not here today. I think he's worshiping online. The man on the right is Troy Jensen. The man on the left is Ken Cock. Do you say Ken's last name Cock with a high, like a rooster or Koch? I've heard it pronounced both ways. Okay, I thought so. Okay. I don't know the elders very well, do I? I really do. But if anyone desires or has aspirations for the office of a bishop or an overseer, he desires a noble task. Ken and Troy both recognize this. For Ken, it was so weighty that when he was asked, he asked for more time to consider it. And he took a whole year to think about it and to pray about it. And he wrestled because he felt inadequate. He said that he felt like he's not the most knowledgeable about Scripture. that he's, I'm quoting him, at best, an average teacher. Now, I beg to differ with that. I think Ken is a great teacher, but he feels like he is, at best, an average teacher that doesn't know Scripture the way that he could or should. And he said that he gets terribly anxious when he has to speak in front of people. Troy also knew that the call to being a bishop and overseer was a weighty task. Troy said he was asked about 5 times to be an elder, but he declined after prayer and thought each time for various reasons. Either because he felt like he was too busy and he couldn't give enough time, because he had work and family, or that he wasn't ready. Plus, Troy mentions that he is, I don't know if you know this, but he is, in his words, highly introverted, who struggles to converse and doesn't care for crowds. I think, given what these two men have shown, they recognize the weightiness of the task. In fact, early Christian manuals of people that were called to be pastors, they used to say, this is the guy we want, and then they'd have to go and drag them, and they'd try to run away because they felt like they were inexperienced. You don't want to put me as a pilot of a ship or flying an airplane unless I don't want to be responsible for that kind of thing. And I think these two men felt the weightiness of that task. And so the shepherding role is not easy. It is a noble task. It's a high calling. And the overseer must be above reproach. Now we're going to go through 14 or so characteristics that I think outline what it means to be above reproach, or what Paul will say in Titus, an elder must be blameless. And so Troy writes that the shepherding role is not easy. He says that it will cause you to have sleepless nights and will tear you up on the inside and make you cry at times. You think about the before and after pictures of certain presidents when they go into office and when they leave office after 4 or 8 years. So I want to show you, these are Troy and Ken's after office pictures. Let me show you what they looked like right before they started being elders. If you could see, Ken's got his chest hairs going on in there, and that phone looks like it's from the 80s. I bet Ken is so, he'll say this, he feels unskilled at technology. I bet he's still using that phone. It's probably still in the house. One of the ones, you know, you had to kind of. But that was Ken right before he was asked to be an elder. He looked like that. And then now he looks like that. He's still smiling. And Troy looks like he could have been Napoleon Dynamite. But Troy writes again that. Now, these are for a long, long time ago. I'm just joking. As you can see, handsome then, handsome now. But Troy again writes that the shepherding role is not easy. It will cause you to have sleepless nights and will tear you up on the inside and make you cry at times. But God is growing you through those times and helps you learn to love people more like him. And as I am typing this, yes, I have tears in my eyes. What a shepherd. I am thinking that through this, I'm getting a glimpse of what God has gone through and what he has felt at times when his children walk away from him. And from my 4 months of working under the leadership of Troy and Ken, I can attest that these are some godly men that care deeply for this church, that do have sleepless nights and wondering about what kind of decision they should make when, regardless of what decision is made, it will cause some pushback. And so I appreciate them, and I know we all do as a congregation. But that just goes to show you about why this is a noble task. And it's why, in fact, one of the most common metaphors for pastors is a physician. They have to know how to care for different souls. Sometimes you got to cut and cauterize and burn. Sometimes you have to soothe. Sometimes you have to scold. Sometimes you have to be gentle. And it takes a special person to know when exactly to apply that to different people in their flocks. And so there are some tough things about shepherding. But there are also some high pros to it. And Troy writes this. Despite the fact that he is an introvert that prefers to not be the center of attention or would love to just avoid crowds, he loves being with people. He says, the most fulfilling thing to me is having interaction with the family and learning more about them, listening to their needs and struggles, and then praying with them. I love helping people as much as I can, and I believe that is a key role for the church as well. We are told to take care of the widows and orphans. So once again, 1 Timothy 3, verse 1, here is a trustworthy saying. Now, there's some debate among commentators about whether the trustworthy saying goes with what Paul says about the overseer or what he previously said about women. Women will be saved through childbearing. The reason for this is because most of the trustworthy sayings have to do with salvation. And what Paul says about elders has nothing to do with salvation. I'm not convinced one way or the other. I'm not dogmatic about it. I just wanted to present that as some options for you. I think there are good arguments on both sides, but I just wanted you to know that. Here is a trustworthy saying. Whoever aspires to be an overseer desires a noble task. So it's a high calling. Therefore, the overseer is to be above reproach. And there are certain characteristics that I'll go through. But first, I want to deal with a couple of problems in the text. If you look on the screen, you'll see that it says, from verse 3 down, the overseer is to be above reproach, faithful to his wife. He must see that his children obey him. Now, there are different interpretations of what literally Paul says, a man of one woman, the type of man that is faithful to one woman. And it's translated in different ways. You can see in the NRSV, NAB, it says, married only once. So this is a person that can, in his entire life, be married only once. You see in the NIV, it says faithful to his wife, which could be taken to mean that, well, if someone has been biblically remarried, as long as he is faithful to his current wife, then he can be an elder. Now, there's another translation that says he must have only one wife, which in the ancient world would speak against polygamy, which was common. Either that, or people that were not married and had relationships with various women. There are some philosophers that say we have wives to bear legitimate children, mistresses and concubines for pleasure. And so if that is in the background of what Paul is saying here, it could very well be that he's not saying that a man must be married, but the type of man that the bishop must be is that whoever he's married to, he must be faithful towards. And so I just want to present the complexity because I am not certain that a bishop has to be either married or that he has to have at least two children. You see that it says his children obey him. So if, does that mean he has to have two children? Well, what if he has two children and then one passes away and he's an elder? Does he now have to step down? What if he's married and then his wife died? Does he have to relinquish the eldership? And you can see we could be very legalistic with this, but it's also appropriate to be cautious. And what I want to leave you with in here is certainly, I think we can say that Paul is exhorting a person who is married and has children that he must be faithful to his wife and he must have children in subjection to him. That's certainly what we can say. I'm not certain that it would exclude a person that's been married more than once, let's say their wife has passed away and they're married again. I'm not certain about it one way or the other. I only raise it because in the history of the church, there's been debate about it from the very beginning, and I don't want to be dogmatic about it. Paul says elsewhere that he prefers, if people can do it, that they're not married because they can be devoted to God solely. And so he uplifts singleness and ministry. And so I think that needs to be kept in mind. And so it may well be that there are certain limitations, but certainly the person has to be faithful to his wife if he's married. That's what I want to leave you with there. Everything else in the text is not up for debate. Those two things I know people have different views on. So I wanted to get those kind of out of the way first and help us appreciate the complexity of those things. So I want to talk about the qualifications of an overseer. Look at verses 2b. Here's the first point. The overseer must possess a godly disposition in every area of life. Now look at the characteristics. I understand verse 2 to say, now the overseer is to be above reproach. And then what follows are characteristics that indicate how one is to be above reproach. And so going through verses 2b all the way through verse 3, and we'll stop there, faithful to his wife, temperate, self-controlled, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not given to drunkenness, not violent but gentle, not quarrelsome, not a lover of money. And we'll stop there. So the overseer, this is how I sum up that in those entire two verses. The overseer must possess a godly disposition. His orientation must revolve around God. There must not be a single area of his life that is not oriented toward God. Now, this is not to say that to be above reproach means that an elder is called to perfection. I think it means that while an elder does have faults, and Troy and Ken both recognize their inadequacies, they don't have extraordinary blemishes that would prevent them from continuing in their roles as elders. And so it's no surprise. Look what comes first. Faithful to his wife, the NIV says. It's no surprise to me that the most important relationship the most important human relationship that a man should have is with whom? His spouse. Notice it doesn't say a man should be faithful to his job first, or faithful to a hobby. What it does say is that this most important relationship, faithfulness to his wife, he ought to be the kind of person that is devoted to his wife, not only physically, but also emotionally. He should support her. He should cherish her. He should nourish her. And I wonder if it's put forth there first, because the relationship between Christ and us is often depicted as Christ and the church, bride and groom. And as Eve was taken from Adam, so as the spear pierced Jesus' side and outflowed blood and water in baptism, we come out from the side of Christ and we are married to him in baptism. So I wonder if Paul puts it there first, because if an elder is a man who loves his wife and cherishes his wife, then he'll also be one who is faithful to take care of the church. Conversely, if that man is not faithful, if he's not the kind of one-woman man, then it's quite likely that he's not going to fulfill adequately his responsibility to love the church as he loves his spouse. The next three words, temperate, self-controlled, respectable. I think they can all be put together. They all deal with restraint. Kind of like when you have a bridle for a horse. You know, on a horse, you have the bit, you have the little head stall that goes over the head. And then you have the reins. And what does this do? It helps the horse stay in line so that it doesn't go all over the place. In the same way, people that are qualified to be elders have their lives under restraint. Under the bridle of what? The Holy Spirit. So that their thoughts are in line with what God wants. Their desires are in line with what God wants. They know how to respond to drinking and food and things like that so that they don't eat to excess. They don't drink to excess. Next, the elder is called to be hospitable. Why is that important? Because it was often the elders that would host the churches in their homes. And if you're going to be an elder and hosting people in your homes, then you need to be a person that is hospitable and welcoming and open. This goes beyond merely certainly includes opening up one's house, but I think in our culture, it could mean being present. Welcoming in terms of being there for a person, being hospitable, not always trying to get away, fully present when someone is talking, certainly opening up one's home. Missionaries relied on hospitality. And Paul travels to Athens and other places, say, he doesn't worry about where to stay. He's going to stay with some of the believers. Prepare a guest room for me, he tells Philemon. And so early Christians, to spread the gospel, they wouldn't have to say, oh, I'm going to Missouri, I'm going to Virginia, and we're going to have to book a hotel. Oh, they would just say, let's go to Athens, and the Christians will open up their homes for us. Now, the dangerous thing about hospitality is that it was onerous, because hosts had to supply everything that travelers needed, and certain people abused their host goodness. As a result, many people kept their doors closed and didn't welcome people, which may be why 1 Peter 4:9 says, show hospitality to one another and do it without grumbling. People may take advantage of you, but the bishop, the overseer, the elder has to be a person that is hospitable. His home should be open. He should be able to teach. Now, there's a difference between having knowledge and teaching. Perhaps some of you have had professors or teachers that were very knowledgeable, but they weren't the best at translating their knowledge in a way that you could understand it. There are people that can speak really well, but that teach bad theology. There are people that don't know that teach. Well, the bishop needs to be both. He needs to be a man that knows the faith, and he also needs to be able to break down that knowledge for our profit and edification. So he needs to have knowledge, and he needs to be able to teach so that we are upbuilt and built up. And why would this be important in Ephesus? What's going on in Ephesus? All kinds of false teaching. And so you can see the necessity, especially in our culture, when there's all kind of stuff going on in schools, on TV, and in other places. The bishop, the elder, needs to know the faith and to be able to help us be built up so that we can withstand the false teachings that are coming in various places, from the internet, from the TV, from the classroom. He must be not violent, but gentle. An elderly couple talk in the evening. Honey, I'm so sorry that I let out my anger at you so often. How do you manage to stay so calm with my foul moods? I always go and clean the toilet when that happens. And that helps? Yes, because I'm using your toothbrush. Now that's passive aggressive. One could be full out violent and respond, but the elders are not to be violent. They're not to be passive aggressive, but they're to be gentle. That's probably why gentle is right next to not fighting, not violent, but gentle. When people come at elders some type of way, they're not to respond in kind. They are to respond gently. John Calvin said it the best, and I'll just quote him. Gentle means this. He says it means to bear injuries peaceably with moderation. One who excuses much, who swallows insults, who does not make high, who is not dreaded for his harsh severity, but a person who knows how to moderate, a person who is not harshly severe, one who is gentle. And I've seen this personally in the elders, when they respond to things that would have many people very furious. They've often counseled, well, let's take some time to pray about it. often it's been the case in my experience with Troy and Ken, their first response to almost anything, especially difficulties, even if it's friction, is we need to take some time and we need to pray about it. Lastly, verse 3, the man who is called to be a bishop, an overseer, must not be a lover of money. Now, why is this the case? Because bishops were often responsible for church funds in the early church, and sometimes they abused them. Polycarp, a second century Christian, writes about a presbyter named Valens who abused the church funds. And he says, I am grieved for you about Valens, your presbyter, your elder. And then he warns those who would be leaders to avoid the love of money. Pure capitalism, Tim Keller says, all your money belongs to you. Pure Marxism says, all your money belongs to the state. Christianity says, all your money belongs to God. And the elder especially should know how to rein his finances in so that he is not pursuing wealth to the point where it takes him away from his faith, or that he loves money. So those are some areas where the elders, those who are called to be elders, bishops, should have a godly disposition. But many of those qualities, I think, should apply to us as well. Could it be that we were called to be leaders? What's our response to our relationships? Romantic relationships. Are we the kind of faithful one-woman men or one-man woman? How do we think about money? Are we able to swallow insults when people come? Not violent, but gentle. Are we people who take wine in excess and it leads to other things, like arguing? That perhaps may be why Paul puts not given to excess wine before being violent and quarrelsome. I know people that when they drink, it leads them to do things that they shouldn't do. They drink in excess. It leads them to argue. It causes them to call up the past. It causes all kind of stuff. And I think Paul would say, well, perhaps you need to consider, if you can't drink in moderation, then perhaps it's best not to drink at all. What areas in our life need changing so that we can say that if God called us to be elders or church leaders, that we would meet the qualifications in verses 2 and 3? Verses 4 and 5, the overseer must be a respected leader. Let me read verses 4 and 5. He must manage his own family well and see that his children obey him. Now, the word obey here to refer to children is the same word as submit in chapter 2, verse 11, we talked about last week. A woman should learn in quietness and full submission. The same word is used for children. It's translated differently in the NIV. He must manage his own family well and see that his children are submissive to him, and he must do so in a manner worthy of full respect. Now look at verse 5, because there's a relationship between leadership in the family and leadership in the church that I think is also important for what we talked about last week. It makes another doctrinal point. Verse 5, if anyone does not know how to manage his own family, how can he take care of God's church? And so what that tells us is that the overseer is a steward. He is placed in charge of the church. He does not own the church. God owns the church. It's God's church, but the elder, the bishop, is called to oversee and take care of it. And so the home is like a little church. Proper order, I think all of you who are parents, how many of you are parents? The proper order in the house is that children don't rule the parents. Parents rule the children. As much as sometimes that's not always the case, and as much as some children would like it to be different, proper order, I don't think any parent in here would agree, dictates that the parents are in charge and the children are to submit. So that's the proper order. It's not parents over children. And of the parents, spiritual leadership biblically is given to the male. In the same way, leadership in the church reflects how leadership in the home should be. I should say this here. Some women, many women, for various reasons, have to take on the role of a mother and a father because the father has done a poor job of being there for the children or has left. And they do a magnificent job. And I want to acknowledge that fact. There are many different scenarios. And you may be a woman who has the role of being mom and dad and other things and working. And God bless you for doing so. That's important. So, but the leadership generally in the church reflects how leadership in the home should be. The church is owned by God. And everyone in his house submits to him. It's his church. And so that includes the men. Whatever leadership that men are called to have, it is God's house. And because it's God's house, everybody in the house submits first to God. And if a man is called to lead, then the woman follows the man who is following God. And the children follow the parents who are following God. And the slaves follow the parents who follow God. So the church is owned by God and everyone in his house submits to him. And so qualified men responsible to the chief shepherd, as Cliff pointed out, are to exercise authority over the church in his name, modeling godliness to such an extent that we willingly follow their leadership. Notice that's what biblical submission is. And that's why Paul says, the children who submit, submit to a person who is worthy of full respect. Submission comes because the lifestyle of the leader is so dignified and so honorable that it evokes respectful submission as a natural response. The children look at the father and they look at the mother and they see godliness shining out and they say, I respect her, I respect him, therefore I submit. That's biblical submission. That is biblical submission. And so what comes first? The chief shepherd. Jesus says, I lay down my life because I love the sheep. He submits to death because he loves the sheep. The overseers say, we'll follow Jesus in exercising our authority sacrificially. So Jesus lays down his life, the elders exercise authority following the example of Christ, and then us in the congregation follow the elders as they're following Christ. That's a biblical understanding, I think, of submission. Why? Because what they do evokes and prompts respectful obedience from us. And that perhaps helps us to think about what we talked about last week, when we talked about submission in the text for women's roles, submission of children. And so the women and the children here are told to obey the father and the mother. Lastly, verses 6 and 7. The overseer must be fully approved. In other words, he must be from the inside out, he must be approved. Verse 6 talks about the inside. He must not be a recent convert, or he may become conceited and fall under the same judgment as the devil. Now, what's the danger here? You notice the parallelism between verses 6 and 7. They both talk about falling into something associated with the devil. He should not be, there's a negative command, he should not be a neophyte, a newly planted man, a newly planted woman. He should not be a neophyte. Why? Because there's the danger of falling into conceit. There's the danger of this person has been in the church for 20 years. You just came on the scene 2 months ago and you're uplifted to an elder and you might think that you're above such and such a person that should be an elder or should be considered, but you've been considered. And so in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 4, the same word is used, but it's placed in between people that are rash, conceited, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. There is a tendency for some people, Paul says, if they are promoted as a neophyte, as a recent convert, there's the danger that they will become arrogant and look down on other people, to be self-focused, focused on their own abilities and not on what God has done. And so Paul cautions that in this church, in Ephesus at this time, that candidates seeking to be elders should not be recent converts. Now notice that that says something about the church at Ephesus. It seems to say that they've been in existence for a while. If there is a pool from which the people can draw, that there are both recent converts and older people to choose from. He doesn't say the same thing in Titus, perhaps because the church there is more elementary. And perhaps there's a need for any people that are qualified. So the first thing, fully approval means that must not be a recent convert. That's the judgment from inside, from the church. Then there's the judgment from the outside, verse 7. He must also have a good reputation with outsiders so that he will not fall into disgrace and into the devil's trap. Now imagine if we discovered that Ken was involved in some very crooked business practices. Ken works as, he's a chiropractor. He has a chiropractor business, and I think Peggy works at the same place. Imagine if we found out as a church that Ken was involved in some crooked business practices, and it was blasted all over the news, and then people came here and said, that same guy that's doing all that stuff out there is an elder in your church? You can see how the devil can use that and how he does use things like that. Or what if we found out from reviews of Ken online that he routinely cursed at his clients? Or that he's been in a bunch of brawls at the Milwaukee Brewery because he drinks to excess and he gets into fights at the local pub? Now, what if we found that out and people came here and they said, that guy is your leader? Exercising authority? That brawler? That guy that speaks filthy, that doesn't care about people? Now, thankfully, that's not who Ken is, and it's not who Troy is, and I can say that for a fact. In fact, I did my due diligence, and I looked up reviews of Ken online to see what outsiders said about him, and Peggy, and I'll show you what they say. Dr. Koch is very professional, knowledgeable, and experienced. When I came under his care, I was deeply concerned about my physical well-being. And he has not only provided me with excellent chiropractic care, but has always been honest, frank, and highly personable. He thoroughly explained my problem and allowed plenty of time for question and answers. I felt comfortable. Dr. Koch is extremely knowledgeable and caring. He is a very kind and honest man. He explains things so well. Now, where do you get this idea that this guy's not a good teacher? Everybody's saying about him that he's so knowledgeable and that he cares for people and that he explains things so thoroughly, they just love the guy. He explains things so well that you at once feel trust. That's so important when you're in pain. He's honest. You see, 2, 3, 4 people saying this man is honest goes to show you that they know that there are people in the chiropractic field or in the medical field that are trying to milk them for money. But Ken is not that kind of person. He's honest, and that is what you want when you are seeking treatment. Now, I didn't include this, but there are frequently responses that say, and Peggy is wonderful. She knows who you are when she comes in. She's the sweetest person. Lastly, he took a real interest in everything I had to say. He listens to how you are doing. Isn't that important as a bishop? As an overseer, a person that is willing to listen, a person that can explain things, a person that is honest, a person that is caring. He listens to how you are doing, then he sends you on your way, letting you know you don't need another appointment. But if anything changes, he is there for you. Grace, these are the kind of elders that we have at this church. These are men that care for these people. These are men who would lay down their life for the sheep. These are men that recognize their inadequacies, that recognize the weightiness of the task. Ken says, I get anxious speaking. Troy says, I'm introverted. But both of them did not allow what they felt to be inadequacies to prevent them from becoming shepherds of this church. And I asked both Troy and Ken, where are they hoping to take this congregation? This is what Troy said. And I'm ready, given what I know about Ken and Troy, and given the outside testimony, I'm ready to follow them where they lead. I'm willing to trust them. I'm willing to trust their timing. I'm willing to know that they have sleepless nights and that they cry about certain things that we are not aware of. And Troy says he falls asleep easily, but he often has sleepless nights thinking about and wrestling with some of the decisions that he has to make as an elder. And he gave me permission to share all of this. I'm submitting by following his permission. But this is what he said about the direction he believes he wants to see God take this church. I really believe that God is calling the family at Southside to be more proactive about getting active in the community around the building. Learning about the neighborhoods and people that make up the area, what are their needs and how we can possibly meet them. I would like to see us have more of a ministry of serving outside the family, taking time as a family to go do things for the hurting, the hungry, the homeless population, and serving them and showing God's love to them. Ken says this, as I reflect upon the challenges during my time as an elder, I find myself thinking about the number of times the elders have asked members to consider stepping into certain positions, duties, but were declined. There certainly are times because of circumstances where this was probably the correct decision, but so many times people declined again because of fear that they may fail. I believe this fear of failure has even affected our ability to witness to other people. Others decline because these ministries do require time and industry that they feel they cannot or do not want to, devote to at this time. I guess I find this challenging because I believe that God has given us all the tools and the talents we need at Southside, not only to survive, but to thrive if we all use what he has given us. And I think, speaking for the elders from what they read, I think one of the ways they would want us to respond to this sermon is not to have to be tapped to do things, but to come to them voluntarily. To recall again their own inadequacies, what they felt, the weightiness of the task. And it may be legitimate that you have some concerns or some fears or failures about getting involved, but look at the elders. You got a man who I get anxious every time before I speak. I'm highly introverted. You've got two elders that say similar things, but they get up and they teach and they do things. They're trying to model. Even when they feel weak, they're allowing God to use them. And so I think the response of the sermon today would be to follow the leadership of the elders, to hear what they are calling us to do, and to say, I want to get plugged in. To voluntarily come and to say, I want to get plugged in with a ministry. And if they tap you, then prayerfully consider how you might get involved. I used to visit a man named Mr. Foster. He's deceased. I would visit him. I would walk home from high school. On the way home, I would visit him almost every day, in part because he would make me cashew butter sometimes. And he was still driving his 80s, and I would be very scared. Old Mr. Foster in his 80s would be driving, and he'd be speeding sometimes, and I'd be like, I don't know if I'm gonna make it. But Mr. Foster was kind of old school, and he prayed in King James kind of English. And he prayed the same prayer every time he prayed, and I remember the first part of it. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank thee for this another beautiful day. Hallowed be thy name. And then he would go on, and he would pray for the youth, and he would say, guide, guard, and direct them as thy assistance they stand in need of. Guide, guard, and direct, and give them the assistance they need. And I think that that is true of the elders. God has given us Troy and Ken and perhaps future candidates to guide, guard, and direct us as they follow the chief shepherd. And our task is to follow them as they follow Christ. Come and allow us to pray for you. And if you need to give your life to the chief shepherd who laid down his life for you, we would love to assist you in that today. But if we can pray for you as you evaluate, are you a respected leader in areas where you have authority? Do you have a godly disposition like the qualifications that are called for elders? Are you fully approved by outsiders? Would outsiders say the same things about you and me that they would say about Ken? Those are things that are worth reflecting about in the text, but I want to leave you with the exhortation for all of us, myself included, to follow the elders as they follow Christ, our chief shepherd. Let's stand and give God praise.